You are listening to Serve, Protect, Lead, a podcast from the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where you will hear from IACP leadership and police leaders across the globe sharing wisdom, insight, and perspective.
My name is David Shipley, Executive Director of the Colorado Information Sharing Consortium, retired Sheriff's Office Commander, and your moderator. Welcome back to the IACP CJIS Policy Modernization Podcast Series. As you know, the FBI CJIS policy is changing to meet modern challenges, impact American public safety entities just like yours. Aided by the Advisory Policy Board, or APB, which is comprised of public safety executives from around the country, the CJIS division of the FBI has done its level best to improve CJIS policy intended to help protect all criminal justice data nationwide and beyond. However, please also remember to touch base with your state CSO and ISO to learn the unique aspects of implementation of this updated policy in your state. Today, we present the fifth of at least seven IACP-endorsed Ask the Expert podcast that will cover one of five CJIS policy primary security control groups and their key subtopics from the first two series of revisions. The purpose of our podcast is to present information regarding CJIS policy, something that applies to all public safety personnel, in a stimulating and value-adding way. Our expert panelists today are from the Athens-Clarke County Police Department in Georgia, Deputy Chief Keith Kelly, co-vice chair of the LEIT CJIS Policy Modernization Working Group and an esteemed member of the FBI APB. Welcome to the podcast once again, Keith.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
You bet. Welcome back to popular South Brunswick Police Department, New Jersey Sergeant George Vitt. Sergeant Vitt also serves on the board of the IACP Law Enforcement Technology Section. Howdy, George.
Thanks for having me again.
You betcha. Welcome once again to San Luis Obispo Police Department Chief Rick Scott, a 27-year veteran. Chief Scott serves as the chair of the IACP LEIT Technology Section, is a tenured member of the IACP Computer Crime and Digital Evidence Committee, and the workgroup Task Team 2 leader supporting these podcasts. Rick, it's good to have you here once again.
Thank you, Ship. It's a pleasure to participate.
Welcome also to Crystal Combs, Assistant INT Director for the City of Charlotte, North Carolina, an LEIT board member and my tremendous friend. We are honored to have you here, Crystal.
Thank you, Chip. It's an honor to be here.
And now I'd like to welcome a new voice. Please welcome Mr. Donnie Sowen. He's a law enforcement subject matter expert, a new business development executive for CPI, or Computer Projects of Illinois, and a part-time patrol officer in Wilton, New Hampshire. Many thanks for joining us today, Donnie.
Thanks for having me, Chip.
Wouldn't be the same without you. Glad that you're here. And then finally, the last word of FBI CJIS policy expertise, a good sport, a good friend, and a tremendous panelist, the information security officer for the CJIS division of the FBI, for which he has worked for nearly 30 years. Please welcome Chris Weatherly.
Thank you, Chip. It's always a pleasure to be here.
You know, Chris, in every podcast in this series, there's been the need to apply a pertinent and valuable phrase because it provides context. Do you recall what that is?
Sure do. It depends.
Exactly. So I found a related science question for you. Okay. Does a photon moving through two slits act like a particle or a wave?
Well, Chip, I guess it depends upon how you look at it.
Now that you mention it, I guess it does. Okay. Listeners, welcome. Here we are bringing you the fifth of seven planned CJIS podcasts. You know, we've received some anecdotal feedback indicating there actually are listeners out there who gain value from these podcasts. For that, we are all truly grateful because it means we get to finish what we started. Today, this august panel will help bring practical clarity to the first of two detailed discussions regarding systems and information integrity. Here we go. Everybody ready? Policy 5.15 SI2 requires established systems to A, identify, report, and correct system flaws, B, test software and firmware updates related to flaw remediation for effectiveness and potential side effects before installation, C, install security relevant software and firmware updates within the number of days listed after the release of the updates. And in the measurement of this, there are critical changes that need to occur within 15 days, high 30 days, medium 60 days, and low 90 days. So question, how can agencies, especially larger agencies, manage the massive number of software applications each one puts to use?
So I can speak to that a little bit, Chip. So I think it's really important to have a comprehensive inventory of all your software applications, right? And to set up a recurring patch schedule for each of them or the servers slash environments they're installed on, right? Second, identifying owners and testers for each one of those applications and creating testing windows to validate each application basic functionality in a test environment before the patch is applied to the production environment. Setting up the cadence can be very involved, but once it's a routine process, it really becomes business as usual event each month. And the way that we do it is we stagger our updates, right? So we have first Sunday, second Sunday, third Sunday, and fourth Sunday patching. And that way you aren't impacting all of your customers all at the same time. There are planned outages. We know exactly what patch group, you know, specific servers, then, you know, applications are involved in that patch group, and it then just becomes a routine. So agencies really also need to keep in mind that some vendors must approve the patches being applied, especially for CAD environments, things like that. And so agencies must also keep in mind that some vendors must approve the patches being applied. So it's very important for our vendor partners to be proactive with testing patches as well. One additional note is to make sure that your cloud vendors are addressing this item and that items are included into your contract that holds vendors accountable for meeting this this criteria.
Now, I'll add to what Crystal mentioned. You know, one of the important things is the planning part. So some things are better updated on a weekend when, you know, there might be less administrative staff around. Other times, you don't want to do a patch on a Friday when no one's going to be around because you're not going home at 4:30, you know, or right before vacation. So some of these things have to be kind of, you know, planned out. And speaking to vendors usually gives you some sort of expectation.
And I'll add to that. I think there has to be a lot of good coordination with your units out in the field as well, ensuring that there's not a critical event that's happening or even a planned event that's happening that creates interference with that. The last thing we want to, Sergeant Fitz's point is our systems going down when we have an event that's occurring that we're going to need them. So I think there's a lot of close coordination there. And what Crystal is laying out as far as timelines are typically and traditionally lower activity timelines or time periods, but it's ensuring that it's not interfering with operations.
That's a great point. I know we always check with our ops command to make sure there isn't anything going on. And we get the all clear before we even start work, even if we do have planned work, because we never know when something's going to pop up.
I think Crystal makes a great point, that as well as key. And when looking at this from an agency standpoint, we must be cognizant of any recurring costs with increasing our patching or our cyber hygiene cadence around this standard. We understand that there could be personnel resources involved with the agency in testing these solutions before they go live, or relying on those vendors that provide these resources to the departments.
Sounds to me like a lot of uncommon common sense.
So, lessons hard learned, I would say.
So that leads me to another question. What concerns exist for operating system vendors with regard to this rule, and what are the impacts or additional concerns for users?
I mean, I'm happy to weigh in a little bit on that. And I would say vendors of all types, right? Whether you're an OS vendor, a software application vendor, whatever the product is, they should be aware and diligent of these requirements for patch testing and patches impacting the OS, paying careful attention to the recommendations that they may make for configuring high availability cluster configurations and things like that, to help people really understand, okay, this is my configuration. Well, this specific Microsoft patch may have had a very big impact on cluster. So they need to be paying attention to that.
Shep, this is Chris from the Bureau, and I'm glad to hear Crystal talk about that high availability cluster scenario that we're talking about here, because if you get, you know, as I'm listening to the chiefs and the law enforcement professionals on this podcast, they talk about doing patches on the weekends and not on a Friday, and be cognizant of your events that are going on. If we get a critical patch or a zero-day exploit, it may be possible, if you're in a high availability configuration, as Crystal's saying here, that you can do a rolling patch, right? You bring down one part of that system and patch it, see how it's going to work, and then do that rolling patch. So I'm very glad to hear the professionals on this podcast, talking about how they're patching within their agencies, and they're actually bringing in some pieces of the policy that's yet to be released, but it'll just be additional cannon fodder for them, if you will, because they're talking about maintaining proper configuration, maintaining, getting everybody's buy-in on this change before we make the change, etc. So it's very, very great to hear that these law enforcement professionals are already cognizant of that. So this future iterations of the policy may not be as new to them when they come out.
Okay. Now, for maybe you and I'd like to see about Donnie and Keith on this one. Has the APB or the FBI determined how this requirement would impact patching tools already in use? Donnie, you have a vendor perspective in addition to a law enforcement perspective.
At CPI, we usually do state level stuff. However, we do a lot of individual agencies as well. So when we patch something, we're going to do it on the state level and then push it down through. Typically, when we do that, we like to do it on, like everybody said, a weekend. Normally, it's like a Sunday night at early in the morning, or maybe a Monday morning at like 2 a.m. or something when there's very low traffic. And a lot of times, we make sure that we have everybody on standby. We'll test it in our own facility first to make sure that it works, and then we push it through. Because if there's a bug in it somehow, sometimes, people will do the Java updates. A lot of colleges will do them immediately. They might have directives that they have to push it out immediately as soon as it comes out. But the problem is sometimes that messes up other softwares that they have. And some patches, like Crystal was saying, are so significantly large that they change things. So your computer that you're used to logging into, there might be a significant enough change on it that it doesn't recognize it now. So now you have to reinstall software. And so for the end users, for the knuckle draggers like me out in the road, you go to log on and you got nothing. And that's the problem. So we try to get ahead of that by testing it before we actually implement it out there, and then send out AM messages to everybody. And like Chris said, if that's going to be the case, then we'll do it region by region and have them update until everybody's all squared. And at least that way, everybody has connectivity.
Yeah, and I think Donnie brings up a great point. We've touched on this a little bit, is really the importance of testing these before we roll them out. There needs to be adequate testing done. It needs to be thorough to ensure that we're not rolling out something that then is going to have to be corrected. That's very important. And really, it can be a time saver in the long run.
Good deal. Well, let's move to just as important a topic. In policy 5.15SI2, (2), this mandates that agencies must determine if system components, and we're talking about the system as a whole, have applicable security relevant software and firmware updates installed using vulnerability scanning tools at least monthly, or following any security instance involving CJI or systems used to process, store, or transmit criminal justice information. So the question is, is there a certain minimum standard for scanning tools that help assure end users that the tool is adequately robust to meet this requirement?
Chip, from a policy perspective, we want to make sure that the vulnerability scanner, the tool that you're using, has sufficient rights. Now we're looking at, are they administrative rights? Do they have the ability to change certain things? No, they're only looking at is this flag yes or no? They're only looking at it from a read-only perspective. So, but you want to make sure that you're the tools that you're running have the proper administrative rights within your system so that it can continue to dig into the components of your system and down to the, you know, perhaps down to the libraries of the system to make sure that it's not, you're not missing pertinent software patches, firmware patches, things like that.
I think in our conversation before, you suggested that these components dig deep into the fabric of the system.
That's right. Yeah, you want to make sure that they're that the tap point that you're using for your scanning tools is not it gives you full access to the system. Let's say it that way, so that your vulnerability scanner has the ability to look into every nook and cranny, because so that you won't miss any you know, applicable patches to your system.
Okay, so we're closing in on the you know, coming to the end of this session, and I need to get another point in. Again, there's a lot to share, so bear with me, but I think that our prior discussion will result in some real clarity. In Policy 515SI3 now, parentheses A, it specifically requires implementation of a signature-based malicious code protection mechanism at system entry and exit points to detect and eradicate malicious code. B, it requires automatic updates of malicious code protection mechanisms as new releases become available in accordance with organizational configuration management policy and procedures. C, it requires configuration of malicious code protection mechanisms. I know this is a lot, folks, but hey, we got to talk about it. One, to perform periodic scans of the system at least daily and real-time scans of files from external sources at network entry and exit points and on all servers and endpoint devices as the files are downloaded, opened, or executed in accordance with organizational policy. And two, to block or quarantine malicious code, take mitigating actions, and when necessary, implement incident response procedures, send alerts to system network administrators and or organizational personnel with information security responsibilities in response to malicious code detection. Indeed, to address the receipt of false positives during malicious code detection and eradication and the resulting potential impact on the availability of the system. Okay,
Chip,
now.
Chip, that's a lot of words, is it not?
It is. Let me try to
distill that down. From a policy perspective, let me try to distill that down. So we want to make sure that we have, this is talking about your virus protection, your malicious code protection mechanisms. You want them at the entry point, at the uppermost point of your network that you control, right? Because when you get out onto something you do not control, think about the internet, and you have malicious code coming in, you definitely want to look at that code coming in or look at that entry point to be able to detect and eradicate that malicious code. Now, the SI3B, you're talking about automatic updates. As virus malicious code service providers, as they get a new signature, they will update their what they're called their DAT files, their DAT files. We want to make sure we get those automatically, that we're not having to go out and continuously poll our virus provider for these new signatures. So we want our systems to automatically go for that. Maybe it goes every 5 minutes, you know, to look for this new signature update. As far as requiring the configuration of the malicious code protections to perform periodic scans, at least daily. Look across your entire system daily to see if you have any malicious code that's been hidden into something there. And then on when you have files that you're opening, when you double click that file and it opens, you know, have your virus protection scan that file real quick. I mean, it'll be something that's not even noticeable to the user, but you want your virus system to scan it before you open it so that it can potentially block some harm. And then when you have something coming in from the outside and it looks suspicious, your system should either one, block it entirely, or send it over to a quarantine part of your network. And that's what the second part of this in two, where you said to block or quarantine the malicious code, tell somebody that it's over there. Tell somebody that you have a potential threat sitting in this quarantine section so that they can go look at it and adjudicate it, right? It may be legitimate traffic, but we need somebody to look at it to see exactly what it is. So I hope that kind of distills down this big part of the policy here. But I, you know, continuing in this podcast, I'm sure we'll get some great expert analysis from our law enforcement professionals here.
Chip, I would just add too, if your agency's not the one maintaining these systems, I know some maintain their own, some have departments they work with, and others outsource it. But regardless, if your agency's not the one maintaining them, you really need to circle back to whoever your contact is. You probably have a managed, or you should have a management control agreement with them, but reach back out to them and make sure they're aware of this change in these requirements.
So this means there's got to be some consideration given to the financial impact such a system might have on agency resources, both are all small, medium, and large. And what I think I heard Crystal say was, it doesn't matter what size your environment, you've got a need here.
Absolutely. I mean, the threat landscape being what it is today, virus malicious code protection of this type really is needed for all environments. It's not just for CJIS protection, it's across the board. So agencies nationwide really should be budgeting for this and creating a comprehensive program to manage it. As Keith said, if the agency themselves aren't responsible for that, at the network layer and the application layer themselves, they really do need to check with the division within their agency or their city or county or whatever that are responsible for it. To make sure it's covered.
Bishop.
So from a chief's perspective, both you and Chief Scott, Keith, you're talked about circling back and making sure you communicate with the responsible people.
Absolutely. We're just saying that you should circle back to the individuals that are responsible for this, make sure they're clear on this. This is important. And I think follow-up conversations are definitely applicable in this case.
And just to add, I just want to highlight the positive relationship we have with the FBI in pushing these issues to the forefront to make sure all of our systems, not only law enforcement systems, but all of our systems are safe and protected.
Outstanding as usual, panelists. There's some answers here for some very important questions with the chiefs.
Hey, I just have one thing to add to this. As a guy that works at a small agency, what we find that's helpful a lot of times, and I see this across the country in my travels and my other job, a lot of small agencies will combine and share a resource like that. Like, our agency's we're just about the right size to have a IT department that is an external one that comes in and does all this for us, right? Because they know what we don't know. But the smaller agencies around us aren't that lucky. They're way smaller. So they jump in on our IT budget, if you will, and we share it throughout. And that really helps. It seems to make a big difference because, you're only as good as the weakest link. So if the guy next to you gets a breach or gets hacked, it can get into your system if you happen to share a CAD system or RMS, which we also do. So I would suggest that if anybody is having budgetary issues or really doesn't know, what to look for, talk to the bigger agency near you and maybe see if you can jump in on theirs.
Outstanding. Today, our expert CJIS policy panelists discussed the first of two sessions covering systems and information integrity, covering flaw remediation, automated flaw remediation status, and malicious code protection. Well, we can wave goodbye to this session, but tune in again next time to hear podcast 6 in this series, panel discussions regarding systems and information integrity. Rest assured, though, that this team will produce at least one more podcast in an effort to answer all the questions that you, the listeners, provided to the ICB. Panelists, thank you once again for sharing your time, practical knowledge, and expertise with our listeners. Everyone who listens and takes what you share to heart is making a strong progress toward compliance with the new modernized CJIS policy. Hey, have I told you how much of a blessing it is to work with each of you? Chris Weatherly, Jim Emerson, George Vitt, Crystal Combs, Keith Kelly, and of course, Rick Scott, and then my good friend, Donnie Solomon. Cannot tell you how much a blessing it is. Listeners, please leave yet another review and questions, and then join what promises to be our fun 6th CJIS Modernization podcast. So until then, may the roof above us never fall in, and may the friends gathered below it never fall out.